Have your attention, please. Everybody take a seat, please. Can everyone take a seat, please? Back, wait one more minute. First of all, welcome. I want to welcome all of you. Good morning. In order to get the CLE credits, everybody has to sign in. And then at the end of the day, or whenever you leave, you have to sign out and do an evaluation form. There were some materials there, CDs or other booklets. And there's coffee and cake. There'll be breaks between each of the segments, and there's coffee and cake and tea and whatever else you need. So the first topic is ethical issues in practice of law. I've been in practice a long time, and I'm still not sure I know precisely how to balance the need to protect and defend your client with the need to defend and protect the clowler, other people, or honesty, or so. What do you do if you know your client is going to swear or take an oath, something that's less than being truthful? What do you do about confidentiality? You have certain confidentiality obligations to your client, but you know something. He told you something that would help the other side, or something that your client is not telling the truth, or some other criminal or bad act that he did. So all these balancing activities are hard for any lawyer, even under secular law. So today we're going to hear the halachic considerations of defending a criminal, or protecting confidentiality when it hurts others, and allowing the client to say less than the full truth. And this lecture will be given by Rabbi Avram Gutman, who's a dayan in the Business Halacha Institute and based in Vad Hadayanim of Lakewood. And without any further ado, I would like to introduce Rabbi Gutman.
Thank you.
Now, questions and answers, try to keep it to the end, and Rabbi Gutman will be happy to answer any questions and answers. But if it's necessary, you can interrupt.
The story is told some 50 years ago. There was a certain court case, as it were, in England. The kehila in England had fired a certain shochet. They felt he was not proper. He wasn't slaughtering the animals properly, and they fired him. Because of that, the kehila, the congregation of the English, the Orthodox congregation, was taken to court in England. And one of the people who was subpoenaed to testify was the chief rabbi. His name was Rav Cheskel Abramsky. And as he was brought up to testify on behalf of the kehila, the lawyer asked him, "Rabbi, is it true that you are the greatest rabbi in all of England, in all of Great Britain?" And Rav Cheskel Abramsky said, "Yes, Your Honor, this is true." So the judge was somewhat taken aback, and he turned to Rabbi Abramsky and said, "Rabbi, is this humility?" To which Rabbi Abramsky answered, "Your Honor, I'm under oath." And the point being that when somebody makes a shvuah, somebody makes an oath, they're really bound that what they're saying is not 90% true, not 99% true, but in actuality, 100% true. We personally had a din Torah where there was a certain witness. It was a car accident. A lady took a stop sign, and the car who was about to enter the intersection, rather than smashing into the lady, he swerved out of the way and smashed into a parked car. The question is that lady, was the lady who took the stop sign, is she culpable for the damage which transpired due to her negligence? So just to verify the facts, we had a witness, and the witness testified, yes, I saw it. It was 2 weeks before. I saw it with my own eyes. She was driving a green Suburban. She took the stop sign, and he swerved out of the way and smashed it. Now, it was a blue minivan. It wasn't a green Suburban. But she was sure, the one who testified, was sure what she saw. So very often, although a person could be quite positive, they had no personal vested interest in testifying falsely, but the facts, as even if a person really tries to get to the truth, very often, it's a little bit often, if you're making a shvuah, if you're making an oath, that would be one issue. But there is a tshuva from the Chasam Sofer that we know that if a person makes a shvuah, which is not true, the Gemara tells us all kinds of nasty things that happen. We know that any other sin, the Torah says, yenake, that a person could do tshuva. Over here, it says, lo yenake. Now, we know that it's always possible to do tshuva, but it means to say that it's much more difficult. A person does a sin, he is personally punished. Here, his family is punished. The whole generation is held responsible for shvuas sheker, if a person makes an oath, which is not true. But the Chasam Sofer, he asked the following question. We know that amongst religious Jews, it is almost unheard of that a Jew would make even a shvua that he believes is true. He's taken to Beis Din, and Beis Din says, okay, either you swear that you don't owe this $10,000, or you're going to have to pay. And it's common practice amongst Orthodox Jews, rather that you pay, rather than make the shavua. And he asks, where does this come from? It's stam, you know, it sounds like ultra-religious Orthodox, like, where does this come from? Why is that? Is it true that is there a problem? And he says, in reality, he brings a medrash. The medrash says there were 1,000 cities, others like there was 2,000 cities, which were destroyed because of the sin of a shvuas emes. A person made an oath, and he was telling the truth, but because of that, the cities were destroyed. And he says, wait, why? What's so terrible? He says, conceptually, the idea of an oath, the idea of a shvuah, for our own knowledge, is, what's a person saying? He swears that this is true, or he swears to Hashem that this is true. The concept is, a person is saying, he's swearing by the truth of the existence of God. He's saying, the same way Hashem exists, and what Hashem is true, so too what I am saying is true. So he's invoking the honor of Hashem and the existence of Hashem in his personal squabble that he has with somebody over $10,000. He says, a person has to have a feeling that his personal squabble is so inferior to the honor of Hashem that it's worth it for him. He should work it out. Make some type of pshara with the person, make some type of settlement, try to negotiate with him. If worse comes to worse, pay the money. Don't go and invoke the honor of Hashem for your personal issues. And therefore, that he says, that's the source of why it is. And he says, taka, to make a shvuas emes is also not permissible. Now, in today's day and age, legally, when a person comes to testify in court, even if they're testifying on their own behalf, they make them swear to tell the truth. Now, if that were the only way for the person to testify, so it's quite probable that he would be permissible, because it's let's say he's there are situations when he's not in a position to just walk away. If it's a question of criminal act, he's going to be thrown in jail, or it's an amount of money which he's simply not capable of dealing with, or he's being asked to testify for a third party, in which case he can't just walk away from it because he was subpoenaed to testify. And therefore, one would argue that it's indeed no longer a question of he's not He's not putting the honor of Hashem above his own needs, because he was subpoenaed to testify. So, however, since we all know that in the United States of America, it is acceptable, they do now allow us to affirm to the veracity of what we're saying, in which case there is no need for him to actually make a shvuah, to make an oath. Thereby, for him to invoke an oath, for whatever reason he would do that, that would again be putting what we would consider an unnecessary shvuah, and therefore he would not be permitted to make a shvuah, to make an oath, but rather it would be appropriate for him to merely affirm that what he is saying is true. Okay, that's one issue which we're dealing with today. Now, the next issue that we're going to deal with today is a very delicate topic. And I have a number of disclaimers that I have to make before we lunge into this topic. And that is as follows. If it's ever actually relevant that the question arises, these type of questions have to be dealt with on a singular basis, one by one, should be asked to a competent dayan, competent rav, before one just goes ahead and makes light of these questions. And the next one, you'll hear what I'm discussing in a moment, and the next point that I need to make is that regardless of what I'm going to say today, it should not be construed that we condone people breaking the laws, or we encourage people to break the law, or that we in any way feel that it's a good thing, and we are not right now encouraging anyone to break the law if the obvious conclusion from what I'm saying is, well, that if so it would come out that I'm encouraging people to break the law, that's not what we meant to say, is being misconstrued. And the issue is as follows. What's the story with defending criminals? A person is a lawyer, and in the course of human events, invariably, I mean, I don't know what type of field of law you're practicing, but it's very, very conceivably possible lawyers will be asked to defend various types of criminals. And what is the Torah perspective, the halachic perspective on defending criminals? Should we do it? Shouldn't we do it? Do we discourage it? Do we encourage it? What's the story? So we're going to try to break this down into various segments, and perhaps we can shed some light on how our approach should be. The first question, there's different types of criminal offenses. There's, let's say a person is defending a violent criminal. A person who engaged in some violent crime where the person, there was severe, I don't want to get specific, the person was a violent criminal. So if the person, or is accused rather, of committing a violent crime, and you, after interviewing your client, are somewhat convinced that the person is not guilty, he did not commit the crime in question. We're not saying he had a reason, you have a way to get him out of the conviction. No, there wasn't sufficient evidence, etc. But rather, it wasn't legal evidence. The point is, you're convinced he did not commit the crime. So it goes without saying, obviously we encourage you, this person shouldn't suffer undue hardship for committing a crime he didn't commit. But obviously the question arises in a situation where you're far from convinced that he didn't commit the crime, or even worse, you're convinced he did commit the crime. So what is our perspective? I understand you can make a few dollars. Ultimately, if you're convinced the person is guilty, so again, we're going to make the following distinction. If there is reason to believe that this person may go out and commit another crime of the same intensity and the same level, so it is obviously clearly forbidden to go and defend this person. The person committed a violent crime, and there's reason to believe he's going to go out. If the day he walks out of jail, he's going to commit another crime. So we don't defend such people. It is not only merely, it's unethical to defend him. The person who would defend him and ultimately be successful in getting this person out of jail or not suffering his sitting in jail for the crime he committed, the person who defended him will ultimately be held responsible for any further crime this person commits. It's not just simply, yeah, it's not an ethical thing to do, you don't want to al tischavil a rasha, you shouldn't hang around Rishon. No. If you are instrumental in having this person go out and commit another, of getting off the hook, and then there's reason to believe he's going to go and commit another crime, so then you are going to be held responsible in Shemayim. I understand in court we don't do that, in the civil law we don't do that, but in halachically speaking, the person is held culpable for the crimes that this person commits. If, on the other hand, you're sufficiently convinced that it was a one-time event, and this person did something which was totally out of character for some mitigating circumstance, he committed a crime, and there's reason to believe, and you're firmly convinced, he will not commit such crimes again, so absolutely, there's nothing wrong, and it's probably encouraged to help this person to live his life in a normal fashion and move on with life. The reason that I'm saying this is because it's important to understand the concept. We clearly believe in Ubiyar Tohara Mikir Becha. We can't have people continuing doing, being a danger to society. That's clear. On the other hand, the concept in and of itself of having a person sit in time out, just sitting and twiddling his thumbs, or perhaps learning how to commit further crimes, we don't view that as a positive movement in society. Really, we believe if a person committed a crime and he caused damage or whatever the nature of the loss that he caused, he has to make compensation. He has to pay back whatever damages were done. But the way we conceptualize compensation is monetarily. What could be done to make the person who he damaged whole? If it's a question of money. Sitting in jail is not a way to merely, you know, it's a way of biding time, but it does not really make the person who was damaged whole. And thereby, unless it's a question of the person further committing additional dangerous acts, we are going to defend the person and have him not sit in jail. Included, by the way, which may sound somewhat radical, included in what I call a violent crime that we're concerned the person may in the future commit another one, and therefore we're not going to defend him. If a person's a reckless driver, he goes through stoplights, matter of course. I remember, I know somebody, he told me he needed to go to court because they were going to suspend his license. I said, they suspended your license? Yeah, it wasn't his fault. I said, what happened? He says, well, he went through a red light. Okay, but why'd you go through a red light? Well, it was 2 o'clock in the morning and there were no cars around and I was sure there was no policeman, so I just went through it. I said, yeah, but so they're taking away your license because you went through one little light? Well, it wasn't the first time. He does this all the time, you know. But he's convinced it's never going to happen again. I mean, honestly, you know, a reckless driver, it's in his blood, it's in his bones. And to defend the person who's a reckless driver, again, if he's not going to sit in jail but they'll take away his license, okay, that's okay. But if the person's going to, you're defending him, he should keep his license, continue acting in reckless ways, which is a danger to society, you got to get the guy out of, you know, get him out of the driver's seat. DWI, same thing. I mean, to say it's perhaps a kal v'chomer, people who drive under the influence, you should not be defending them. They're going to do it again, unless you have some way of guaranteeing otherwise. Now, defending criminals who are white, what we call white-collar crimes. Again, we do not encourage white-collar crimes. It should not be misconstrued. But a person who committed a white-collar crime, and the question of him sitting in jail, again, the same concept applies. On the one hand, we believe that the correct restitution is made monetarily. The person should be paying back the monies that he stole, or the monies that he misappropriated, but it is halachically permissible and encouraged if the person is not going to sit in jail. That would be the preferable fashion. No one is gaining anything from him sitting in the state penitentiary, just biding time. And thereby, we would condone, encourage defending him, but not, again, he does have an obligation to make restitution for what he did monetarily. Now, at this point, I'll open up if anybody has any questions on these two topics which we discussed thus far. Yes?
You talk about the oath.
Yes.
The option to take an affirmation. Let's assume that wasn't available, or just to, is that oath shura to say yourself to God? I mean,
so the answer is yes. See, the problem is when you go from Hebrew to English and suddenly you suddenly want to know, well, what does the word mean? So words mean what they mean, and then you start getting to semantics, but conceptually it's well-worn language that when a person swears to tell the truth, it means he's making a shua. Now, what is a shua? So, and by ending off, it's so help me God, as it were, which is the expression, that's even stronger than a shua. There's two types of shuas. There's a shua and there's an Allah. A shua is when a person swears that what he's saying, but he's swearing by Hashem that what he's saying is true. And when he says, so help him God, so help him Hashem, he's saying, and if what he's saying is true, Hashem should strike him down. So help me means that I should be helped because I'm going to need help if what I'm saying is not true. So it's a shua and it's a very strong shua. Conceptually speaking. Okay? Now, if he says, I'm swearing, but I swear to tell the truth. Yeah, okay. So then he's not using the vernacular for what we mean by Yeshua, but conceptually, yes.
Okay, so sometimes on a written document, right, it says an oath, right? Sworn to, before me. It doesn't say anything about God, right? But
okay.
Sworn to, before me. Now you could cross it out, right, affirmed, and say notaries are signing those all the time. Officially, you're supposed to administer the oath when that person... actually, the notary is supposed to administer an oath. He's authorized by the state to administer an oath.
Okay.
So,
I want to answer the question, but we'll hear from... Yeah?
I don't think a notary swears or signs.
No, but he's saying that he's saying that the person... Right, the notary is not swearing, but he's asking that the notary is saying, sworn before me, that the appellant, the person who's asking him to sign, is now.
The
person who's signing is making an oath. So I will answer this question in two fashions. First of all, he didn't make an oath. Now you're writing, you're affirming as the notary that he made an oath. So while they may grab the notary for saying things which are just ain't so, technically no one's grabbing the notary by the scruff of his neck for signing that he swore he signed in front of me. That's what's meant. So that's not an issue. The second thing is we have a principle in Hilchos Shvuos that a shvuah is only if somebody says it with his mouth, and he has to say it. And thereby, if a person were to write, I hereby swear in writing, so probably it's not considered. He may be in Beis Din, we would hold him to his feet to the fire as if he made an oath, because he admitted that he made an oath, but technically speaking, he's not invoking the wrath of Hashem because he did not ultimately say it verbally. Okay? Clear?
Technically, you could cross out sworn to and write.
I don't think it's necessary. Unless you're very, very... unless you cross every I and dot every T, then... Okay. Yes?
I guess it's a bit of a more theoretical question than what I just asked. But so this relates to what you said about defending a white-collar criminal or something to that effect. And I guess this also implicates other issues, whether it's Masira, things of that nature. So I think it's quite... I don't understand that the concept of... You're saying just making the person whole again, the victim of that crime. But I think that the problem with that, with just imposing monetary damages, if you will, is that there's an insufficient deterrent. Because simply, a person who's committing so many crimes can make a very simple judgment to say, for every time that I'm going to have to pay back, it's still worth it for me to keep ripping people off, because it's a smaller, and whatever it is, it can be very profitable for me. So we may want to introduce something punitive of a different measure than financial measure to be a real deterrent, which is why very often for certain white-collar crimes, we do put criminal, we do attach criminal, measures to that, because we want something, a deterrent. Because very easily, if a person says, if 1 out of 10 crimes, let's say I'm caught, and then I have to pay even 5 times as much, but since the other 5 times I'm not caught, it ends up, so this person could make the victim whole, everybody goes home happy, but here's a person who's still a ganef and is still motivated and encouraged even by the fact that he can walk away scot-free without punitive measures, without jail time or whatnot. So I conceptually, I was trying to understand what you're saying. Okay. Being about the victim and not about punitive.
Okay,
criminal.
Let me say this about that. There is what to be said about the deterrent effect in terms of white-collar crimes. And that's why we gave one of our disclaimers at the beginning of our speech, as it were, that each case has to be judged on its own merit. And it shouldn't be just like, you know, with a broad brush. As a certain individual, perhaps you're familiar, certain individuals who are engaged in, or were engaged in, white-collar crimes, and they were stealing from everybody in this room and half the people out of this room. So it's I don't mean the people in this room, but yes, such people perhaps would need deterrent and we would not encourage defending them. But again, that would have to be decided on a per-case basis. Okay? Yes?
Defense counsel or opposing party prosecutor that's going to sentence the criminal to the judge. So I'm a little confused. When you defend a client, you're defending a client, it's not, you don't hold the penalty on what monetary damage, monetary fine, or what jail time is going to get. That's the judge. So what you're saying is, I don't cop that, because I worked with a judge for the last year, for a year and a half.
Okay.
We don't do that.
Yeah, I understand.
Right now, client, so you're saying is, how do you do that? What, keep them away from the jail. That's the judge.
I understand. No, well, obviously, if you're not going to be capable of presenting a case which will keep them out of jail, then the question is moot. The question is, we're talking about, you are capable of lodging a defense which will keep the person out of jail.
To who?
To the judge. You could file enough arguments. You could present enough arguments that you're a good lawyer. You could keep the guy out of jail. There are ways. I'm not a lawyer. I'm sure you are. And there are ways of presenting arguments that the evidence is insufficient, or it's not does not the way the crime was committed does not reach a level of jail time. Perhaps I spoke about this case. There was a certain situation where a person was engaged in insurance fraud, in which certain person was not covered by insurance, and he was able to get him an insurance policy in which, retroactively, he was able to finagle, as it were, he got the person an insurance policy, and he was covered by insurance. When the insurance company discovered it, they had paid out a certain amount of money, which would have had mandatory sentencing of jail time. I don't know exactly what the amount was. So the defense lodged the following argument. They said, it's not the fact that this person would not have been entitled to insurance, per se. They would have sold him insurance, but they would have sold him at a higher premium moving forward. So based on the new premium moving forward, and he was paying a lower premium based on the fact that he had insurance earlier, it came out that the amount that he stole from the insurance premiums was in the range of, I'm giving up numbers now, $20,000. Although the payments the insurance company had paid was $500,000, but in reality, had he gotten insurance at the higher tier, he would have paid an additional $20,000. And thereby, he didn't steal from the company $500,000, he only stole 20. The judge accepted the argument, and the person had to pay back the money, but he didn't have to sit jail time. So there are arguments. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not telling you what argument will fly and what won't fly. So yes, it is encouraged. If we could perhaps save the person from sitting in jail, we would encourage that. Yes?
How does the lawyer know that he's guilty? He was a witness?
No. So that we say.
Even though he doesn't make the mouth Mirashi, even though we don't accept certain strange evidence, and even all that, I could know because he told us.
Okay, so the concept of Ein Adin Ma'aseh Matzah Merasha basically means that the Beis Din doesn't view the person as a criminal based on his own admission, and thereby we do not give him the punishment, and we don't make him pasul eidos, etc. But between me, you, and the lamppost, if a person tells me that he committed a crime, and I believe that he's not just a masochist who wants to self-inflict punishment on himself. But he's, you could see, you could tell from the situation, he's really guilty, but he's looking for a way out. So, yeah, Einon Masmira doesn't apply to that. And you, as a religious Jew, should have somewhat of a conscience not to send this person, a violent criminal, back out into the street to commit more crimes.
So if he sees somebody being tried, okay, but by the fact that he made an admission, and by the fact that, and all the evidence is circumstantial, okay, and we don't have an obligation to save this guy?
Are we convinced that he committed the crime?
How can I be convinced?
If you're not convinced...
Well, I mean, you say Adam made some out for lunch, maybe it's because people admit to stuff that they shouldn't admit to, or
because they're not saying the truth. People admit to things that are true, although they to their own detriment. That's true, but it doesn't mean they're not saying the truth.
It doesn't mean they are, because there's a whole evidence about false confession.
Okay, if the person's not psychologically healthy, or perhaps he was, the we have reason to believe that it was a forced confession.
Who's going to decide if he's psychologically healthy? We're going to take him to a psychiatrist.
Once again, once again, we're going to go back to what we said. You have to judge this on a case-by-case basis. What is, you know, we do not have to check in our brains at the in the little closet outside the Beis Medrash before we walk into Beis Medrash. Just our cell phones. You have to use your seichel to decide whether there's reason to believe the person is innocent, or there's reason to believe he's guilty. And
well, let's say there's a Sanhedrin.
Yes.
And we release somebody, we're actually committing some sort of crime. We're doing it the same basis. We're releasing him for that reason. Because it's circumstantial, because he can't, it's a false confession.
Okay.
Shouldn't they have some sort of culpability?
So you're asking good. You're really asking Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon asked this very question. Oh, no. I got the Tanoim back. There was a Tana who said, it's a Mishnah in Makos, that said, if we were beyond the Sanhedrin, we would work it out that nobody would ever get killed. Why? Because we would ask questions that the witnesses would not possibly be capable of answering. And we've there. There's the Torah gives us a specific mandate. It's called Vehitzilo Ha'eda. The Sanhedrin has an obligation to try not to kill people. Okay? Killing people is more than just locking them up. Now, on that, the Mishnah says, if you would have engaged in such behavior, such shenanigans, excuse me for saying so, then you would have been marbe roitzchem b'Yisrael. You would have caused more murderers, like you're saying, because there has to be this deterrent effect, A, and B, letting violent criminals out on the street. It's just not a plan. It's not a way to live. So, again, these things have to be decided on a case-by-case basis. We can't just decide it with a broad stroke. Yes?
Yeah, but further than that, I mean, in Gittin, I forget the name of the Tana, that he was blamed for the burning of the Beis HaMikdash because he wouldn't even let them kill the person that wasn't actually responsible for being killed. It was the woman, the animal of giving it to
them. So you're on my side.
Exactly. So
right.
I'm saying that there's a requirement, you know, for the mankind, or however you want to phrase it, that, you know, deterrence has been, right? Did the Melech have the power that even if someone was...
The Melech had power. The Sanhedrin also had the power to kill people when they felt that it was appropriate. A person in the time of the Chashmonoim, there was a person who went on Shabbos and he was riding on a horse, which is only rabbinic. They said, listen, Shabbos is out the window if everybody was riding their horses. And they went and they killed the guy. So, there is a certain amount of latitude the Sanhedrin has to go kifi what is needed for their generation. But again, we are not the Sanhedrin and we just don't go around killing people.
I mean, the question would come up. I mean, in our community, we're saying violent crimes that everybody's looking around saying, it doesn't really happen. But if you took like a more concrete example, domestic violence, which is something that would occur, representing, you know, the husband in the third, assault arrest, I mean, how would that play out, I guess? That would be the most concrete example.
Unfortunately, I don't want to talk about them. There are other examples of what I call violent crimes, which are not necessarily domestic violence. And we're going to leave that unsaid. Yes?
What plea bargaining? In terms of criminal defendants, there's this concern that they go out
So if you plea bargain for certain jail time, how does that affect necessarily the end result of being a cutting a sentence from 20 years to 10? 10 to 5?
So what we're looking for is that it should be a situation when we're convinced that this is not going to, or relatively convinced that it's not going to happen again. I mean, I was once waiting online to pay a traffic ticket, and I don't know why he thought I was doing something, but I was waiting online to pay a traffic ticket, and there was a man there who was about to pay a traffic ticket. He said, he was talking to the person next to him, and the guy said, so what are you going to do next time? He says, next time? There's not going to be a next time. I will never speed again. Like he had to pay a ticket of $350 for going 10 miles over the speed limit. I'm never going to speed again. So a person sits in jail for 5 years. I hope he doesn't sit in jail for 5 years, but if he does, I would hope that it's not happening again. But again, you have to know the psychology of the human being.
But the issue of if I'm representing a criminal defendant, and I know definitively that this person, there's overwhelming evidence in support that there was a violent or any other crime, but if I believe sincerely, I'm just trying to check with you, sincerely that by plea bargaining for a more reduced sentence, that would be enough of a deterrent, it's completely like ethically...
I think that would be fine. I would think that would be sound. Yes.
So if your client is facing death penalty, would you have a trial sentence to get him off? Because why would you go on to the government, the U.S. government, to kill him?
So this is too much above a public discussion, and we're going to move on to the next topic. please let me. Now, the question then arises, similar but not exactly the same. A person is involved in civil litigation, and as any of you who are lawyers all know, there's the nuisance factor. That means if you file enough motions, a motion to dismiss, a motion to suspend, a summary judgment, to change venue, a temporary injunction, you could just keep filing motions, and the guy's going to have to pay a lawyer, that's you guys, to file more motions to defend the motions. And this could go on and on and on. I know of a certain case, it went to the court, and he filed a motion, he wants to go to Beis Din, he went from Beis Din, he filed back to the court, and the court to Beis Din. There were motions and motions. It went on for 3 years or something like this. So, and as not everybody has such deep pockets to continue defending these motions, and thereby, is it what we should call ethically sound practice of law to just keep filing motions until the guy's bled, his pockets are bled empty, and then you move on with life. Huh? Got out of this one. So I believe that before we address the question, you got to know that there's something that predicates this, that precedes this question. And that is, does the person belong in court to begin with? If we're dealing with two Orthodox Jews who are having litigation with each other, you tell your client, listen, mister, you got to go to Beis Din. Now, if he tried that route, he sent the person summons to Beis Din, and the guy refused to come, and the Beis Din said, okay, he's not coming to Beis Din, we're going to go to court. The Beis Din gave you permission, you can go to court. So that's one thing. But if, halachically speaking, you don't belong in court, then no, you should not be filing motions, you shouldn't be doing anything, you should be going to Beis Din. In the event that it requires you to go to court, because the person who you're fighting against is not Jewish, doesn't keep the Torah, refuses to come, he does keep the Torah, but he refuses to come to Beis Din, whatever that means. So the bottom line is, you have no choice, and you have to pursue it in court. So then the question begins. The question begins as follows. Are you wrong? If you're wrong, if your client is wrong, and you're just being a pain in the neck because you could be, so then that's not ethically, halachically permissible. Technically, you're a choylik im aganif. You're helping a ganif steal money because he belongs paying if you know that. Now, obviously, does he owe the money is not a simple question. There are things that are black and there are things that are white, and the rest of the world is gray. And since the rest of the world is gray, if you can't pursue the issue in Beis Din and you're pursuing it in court, It would seem that all is fair in love and war, and court is war. I hate to be so violent, so brutally honest. And the point is as follows. If it is reasonable to assume that your client has a legal standing, legal leg to stand on, so that's the name of the legal game. Now, legally speaking, I don't want to sound like a heretic in civil law, but I am somewhat of a heretic, in that I believe that although there are many, many laws on the books, however, on a daily basis, judges are finding nuances in the law. And this comes thanks to the lawyers. They're finding nuances, and they say, well, it's not so clear, you know, the light wasn't so red, you know. They find nuances, and based on these nuances, they're able to defend their clients. And if that is what the judge will rule in your favor, so then that's the civil law. It's not, etched in stone. If halachically speaking, again, it has to be on a case-by-case basis. If halachically speaking, you're not entitled to the money, you're not entitled to the money. But if halachically speaking, it's not clear. The halacha is not clear. And then it's a question of the decision of the judge. So yeah, you could file motions. And ultimately, if the guy's going to settle with you, so I don't have an issue with that. Perhaps Aaron Marburger has a different take on the matter. I can't say that I'm speaking for all of jury, but I do believe that would be legally and halachically permissible to do that. Overstay my welcome. 5 minutes? Okay. And the last point that I would just touch upon, and that's the concept of confidence, breaking confidence, confidentiality. People who meet with their lawyers are given information, they're shared information with them, that's about their story, what happened. Now, in a situation for a crime which was already committed and you're not allowed to break confidence, so I can't encourage anybody to break the law and tell over to a prosecutor or tell someone to tell a prosecutor that, yeah, the guy committed the crime and let's send him up to the Huzga. We can't do that. But the question that does arise, which is a truly heart-wrenching question, is in the event that the criminal, as it were, confessed to you about the crimes that he committed and that he is going to commit, and you're fully aware of his modus operandi and how he's going to be committing future crimes. Now here, from what I understand, the concept of confidentiality does not apply. It only applies, the judge could tell me if that's correct, that crimes which were not yet committed, there is no confidentiality, and thereby, technically speaking, you would be legally permitted to tell people of what this person told you. So again, over here, there's two separate issues when we're talking about a person getting damaged from the criminal, as it were. There's an issue of where the person is going to commit a, what we shall call, violent crimes against corporal crimes against the person's body, in which case there is a law in the Torah called Leisamoid Aldam Reecha. If you see someone who is about to be physically accosted or hurt, killed, whatever it should be, so there's a Leisase in the Torah, it's forbidden to stand by and just twiddle your thumbs and fold your arms and say, well, you know, I didn't see anything happening. What's it got to do with me? There's Leisamoid Aldam Reecha, and that, there is no answer as, well, I'm going to lose my job, or it's if it gets out that I break confidence, so then no one's going to want to hire me to be their lawyer. That's too bad. We know there's a concept not to be over a loisa say in the Torah, a negative command in the Torah. There's an obligation to give up all your money. Call Hindam, all your money. You got to give it up not to be over a loisa say. And loisama that Amriach is amongst them. You cannot stand by and let this person go and hurt someone, damage somebody in a violent fashion when you're aware of it and just stand by, even if it means you're going to lose your practice. Yes?
If there's a Loisamoid Aldam Reecha for the other guy, why is there
Okay, so the there dam, even though domim have two implications, that means money and it means blood, but losama dam riecho in this case means blood. The person's blood. The fact you're going to lose money. Yeah, yeah. If it's money, we're gonna get to the money in a second. I'm talking about when he's the person going to commit a violent crime, where the person's a danger to society, he'll commit something that's a violent crime, and in such a situation, although you may lose money, but l'sama d'amirecha has precedent. Now, if your life will be in danger, because if he finds out what you did, he'll kill you, or he'll kidnap your children, or whatever it should be. Then we do say chayecha koyim, and your life comes before somebody else's life. That is technically true. On the other hand, if it's only a question of him causing monetary loss to another human being, so then we have a concept. The obligation there comes from hashavas aveda. We have an obligation to make sure that if you see someone's money is about to be lost, you have an obligation to protect them, to defend them from losing money. That is a mitzvah als gemilas chasadim for one person to another. And there's a tshuvas akas reich from the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef says, if it's a question of you losing money against, it's in the Mishnah, you losing money or somebody else's money, then we have what the judge said over here, that your money versus his money, you don't have to give up your money to save somebody else's money. But again, this would depend on the extent. You know, this person stands to lose $10 million, and you're going to lose one client, so then, yeah, maybe it's proper to give that up. Yes?
When you say we're losing money in this discussion, are we talking about, like, hard dollar spending out, or, like, the loss of the opportunity if your reputation not took a hit?
So these things have to be quantified in terms of dollars and cents, absolutely. In other words, if you're going to lose this particular client, and how much is he paying you anyways, considering he doesn't pay his grocery bill, so I don't know exactly what kind of loss we're talking about. But I'm talking about in a situation that if it becomes known that this, you're that type of lawyer who tells, so then you close up shop, so that's your whole financial basis, and then you wouldn't be obligated to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we break, there's coffee and cake here. There are bathrooms that have men's bathrooms that